This is a download from the BBC. To download other programmes or for more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
Hamish Thompson says, "Dear Dr. Livingston and I presume, I was really good, which I really liked. I was really chuffed to hear that Heavy Load was the doctor's pick of the week, but you can't leave us hanging like that. Please tell all, can we have a review this Friday?" This is based on your increasingly annoying habit of when I say, with 30 seconds to go, "So what's the movie of the week?" You choose a movie that you haven't actually mentioned.
Okay, but let me say, if you go to www.bbc.co.uk/MarkKermode, I did do a review of it online because we ran out of time here.
And well, just make sure that you... Right, okay, well, let's do that now, okay? Before we get to the top 10, before we get to the new movies, Heavy Load, which appeared to be the movie of the week,
yeah,
but was unreviewed for radio listeners. Do it now.
Well, basically, what it is it's a rock documentary, which has the thing that so many rock documentaries don't have, which is that it's a film about joy. It's about the fact that being in a band is meant to be a joyous and wonderful experience. And it's about this band, Heavy Load, who come out of Sussex, and they play these kind of incredible punk thrash cover versions. Some of the stuff they write themselves, but some of them are these really odd punk thrash cover versions, most notably that Kylie Minogue song, you know, la, 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 la. You know that one? I think it's called La, 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 isn't it? Or
No, Can't Get You Out of My Head.
Can't Get You Out of My Bed. That's the one, yeah. And and so they do a version of that. Anyway, it's a terrific... And in the band all do all the usual stuff, like they argue and they bicker and they fall out and they fall back in again. And the drummer wants to go solo because drummers always want to go solo. And one of the things about them is that key members of the band are learning disabled. And that's not the centre of the documentary. The centre of the documentary is what it's like being in a gang and what it's like, you know, being in a band which exists to be good fun. And then when they start making a documentary about it, it sort of stops being quite so much good fun as it was before. And I really liked it. I was really charmed by it because, you know, as you know, I've always been in bands. I've always loved being in bands. I did a gig last night with the Subways, who incidentally say hello. So hello to the Subways.
Is this another Dodge Brothers gig?
Yeah, the Dodge Brothers played with you. We did. Yeah, really. It was skiffle and punk together. But of course, the Subways are the band in that Guy Ritchie film, Revolver. So before anything else, we had to have the awkward discussion about, yeah, so you were in Revolver. Yeah, it's okay. I forgive you for that because... Not Revolver. What's it called? Rock and Roller. All Guy Ritchie's films sound like they're the same movie. They're in Rock and Roller. They're not in Revolver.
Sam says, okay, Tweedledum and Tweedledee, let me just clarify, I have drunk copious amounts of lager, but Dr. Kermode, yeah, the Dodge Brothers were so excellent that they defied belief. and it just goes on. I've come back to the Borderline Services gig that you did last week. You were so amazing and absolutely giving.
We were absolutely giving, yes.
You were really, really giving.
With a gift that keeps giving. But we did that gig after your party. We did party. And then
first.
Yeah, anyway. So there was a rock and roll point to all this, which is being in a band is about being in a gang and it's about the joy of being in a band. And the thing I really liked about Heavy Load was it was a documentary about that. You see so many documentaries, whether it's that terrible U2 documentary, Rattle and Bum, you know, in which they're all complaining all the time and, you know, all that nonsense. And it's all that thing, you know, the Some Kind of Monster, the Metallica one, in which they're just all in therapy the whole time. And it was a film about the joy of being in a band, and I really liked it.
Dear Dr. Livingston, and I've done that one.
It was good.
It was good, wasn't it? From Hamish Thompson, yeah. Dear Dr. Livingston, I presume. But this is Stephen Shrewsbury. Dear Top Cat and Dibble, a few shows ago, the good doctor mentioned he was viewing Appaloosa during the week and promised a review for the next show. Whatever happened to it?
Didn't get there. And I'll tell you why I didn't get there. Because the next week, there was 12 movies out. And we didn't even get as far as doing Heavy Load. And here's the simple answer. It used to be that every week there'd be 6 movies released. Nowadays, regularly, there's 12. And we only ever get through... So we're always playing catch-up with ourselves. So I haven't seen a little bit yet. I am, however, now looking at somebody wearing a cardboard cutout of Jason Isaacs. So...
Excellent.
Hello, Jason Isaacs.
And hello, David Morrissey.
Is a cardboard cutout of David Morrissey. A minute ago, it was a cardboard cutout of Guy Ritchie. This is a really strange experience, and I'm not sure it's enhancing it for the listeners.
Hello, Stephen Fry, Kevin Branner, all members of Fairport Convention and Focus.
And Subway. The Subway.
Len on this says, dear Minnie and Mickey, the thing with your face on, well, it will be penny for the guy time soon. No one does that anymore, do they? Speaking of which, can you send the doctor to our firework display? I think it would be better than fireworks to set him in the middle of a field, shout Pirates 4 at him and watch him go off. Spectacular.
Somebody wrote something in a newspaper about a way to make sure Pirates 4 wasn't terrible. And I was quoted in it. It said you should use Dr. Kermode's rule that, you know, Pirates 3 didn't just begin shooting without a finished script. It ended shooting without a finished script. So let's not do that again.
The UK box office top 10 this week includes the following, and in this order. Number 10 is The Women.
I can't now look at that, the name of that movie, without thinking of Kevin Spacey joining in with all of these last week. If you haven't seen it, go back and check it. There's a video thing of it. It's very, very funny. The Women's absolute rubbish. And the question was, whatever happened to Meg Ryan? And he said, in his puntastic way, perhaps she hasn't had an injection of good roles recently.
it was a fine moment. I think we were at number one on iPlayer for that last week, which was rather fine. Fly Me to the Moon at 9.
3D, you know, flies go to the moon. And at the end of the film, Buzz himself turns up and says, you know, this isn't true. Flies didn't really go to them. I mean, it's very strange. The film seems to exist largely to demonstrate that this 3D animation technique works, and it does. I mean, the funny thing is, there's a perfectly decent 3D science fiction movie to be, or 3D science movie to be made about the Apollo missions that it could do now with this. You don't need the stuff about the flies being trapped in the spaceman's helmet. But there we go.
Brideshead Redecorated at 8.
Yeah, and why redecorate Brideshead Redecorated, which seems to be the key? That's the main thing, is why do it? It's funny because it's a strangely inert thing when you see it on the screen like that. It's just, you know, I know everybody loved the TV version, which of course completely passed me by, but there seemed to be very, very little reason to go back and do this story, because it didn't seem in any way kind of, you know, modern or interesting. It was just like, there it is, except for every single moment that Emma Thompson was on screen, in which I thought, that's fine, I'll just bathe in the glory that is Emma Thompson. But she wasn't on for enough.
Righteous Kill is this week's number 7.
Righteous Kill, as it leaves the top 10, and
it's number 7.
That's, I think you'll find that's down. It's going down. It's number 7, so it'll, next week
it's
it'll be number 9.
It's not leaving the top 10 if it's at number 7, is it?
It's directed by John Avnet, and I've decided that I'm just simply not Avnet.
You've been working on that.
I have. In fact, that occurred to me about Tuesday, so I've had about 4 days of working on that. I'm not Avnet.
The Boy in the Striped Pyjamas is this week's number 6.
Bucking everybody's expectations by still hanging on there. I think the thing that all the critics thought, even the ones who liked it, and I liked it very much, was that it would have a hard ride in the cinemas. But the fact that they're still in the top 10, still holding its own, is very, very good, because we said it's a very difficult story about the Holocaust designed for younger audiences, and clearly it has managed to find that balance between being both accessible but also honest to the subject matter.
We have Death Race at 5.
Jason. And now he's holding up a cardboard cutout of Jason Statham's head.
Jason Statham.
Hang on,
so what do you got there? You got a cutout of me and
you,
Jason Isaac.
Someone
laughing hysterically because they've laughed.
Kevin Spacey was here a minute ago. Now it's Jason Statham, who appears to be drinking coffee. Unfortunately, of course, actually the way you should do a cardboard cutout of Jason Statham is stripped to the waist and covered in oil and wrestling with another
man. That does it for you, does
wearing it? Wearing tighty shorts. Well, that's what he does. I mean, I'm sorry. You know, there's not much of interest about the Death Race, which is a remake of a much, much better old exploitation cheapy Corman movie. But on the other hand, Jason Statham, you know, that's what he does. Jason Statham runs around without his shirt on, covering himself in oil in his better roles.
Mamma Mia at 4.
There I go again. And there's somebody writing an email saying, if the movie's so bad, how come it's just entered something like the 50 most successful movies of all time? Because it's so bad, it's brilliant. And it is incredible that if you carry on that path of being really, really bad, you will end up being brilliant. And it has managed to do that. And you've seen it, haven't you?
No, I haven't.
You're actually not having it?
No.
No. You should go and see it, because it's not going to count on DVD. It's not. I know the joke wasn't funny then.
It was average first time. But
I like it, and enough. I'm going to keep doing it. And you're not here, only as a cardboard cutout.
David Anthony. So now we get to Tropic Thunder at 3. Yeah. David Anthony says, dear Doctor and Pseudo Doctor, went to see the underwhelming Tropic Thunder the other day. The most amusing bit was the spoof trailers at the beginning. What made them particularly amusing was the guy behind me clearly didn't realise the normal trailers had finished and said after the Satan's Alley trailer, I'm not going to pay good money to see that. It looks rubbish. I just wonder what the dumbest comment you've heard ever during a movie from a member of the audience.
Well, I mean, the dumbest comment I've ever heard, although it was by a friend of mine, was Nick Cooper. I went to see Eraserhead with him at the Phoenix in East Finchley in a late night double bill with that and the Crazies. And we sat there watching Eraserhead, which I thought was absolutely brilliant. And he's an arch rationalist. And he was sitting there and his knee was trembling all the way through it, because then when he gets agitated, his leg would sort of bounce up and down. And halfway through, when the mutant baby was in the room with the guy with the weird hair and the lady was singing in the radiator, he turned to me and he said, that wouldn't happen.
That's the worst you've ever heard.
Yeah, for heaven's sake.
You need to go to proper cinemas, you know, where they're doing drug deals on the front row, that kind of thing.
I've been to proper cinemas. I paid to see Righteous Kill in a proper cinema.
We got Taken at 2.
Which, you know, Liam Neeson, hits everybody, kills everybody. No, but he doesn't. It's like, I went back and I watched that interview, and he's slightly more lively than you gave him credit for, because at one point he actually smiles very slightly in his But when in the film, he just shoots everybody, and
he does it quite well. He does it with style.
He does, and it's people with baguettes, and it's people with foreign accents, and it's the. I mean, it is. I think I said before that it was borderline xenophobic. I mean, let's be honest, it's not borderline xenophobic. It's just flat out racist. But hey,
No, it's not. I think that's preposterous.
It is. It is. It's a film that says anybody that looks a little
Albanian,
bit foreign, is clearly a bad'un.
Okay, so the UK's number one is How to Lose Friends and Alienate People. It's not doing well here, but it's number one in the UK.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I didn't like the film. I wanted to like it more, and I didn't like it. And I thought it was going to have a very hard time finding an audience. And I'm clearly wrong, because it's. I see on the poster there are some people giving it absolutely glowing reviews. Cosmo Landsman, who, of course, used to work with Toby Young, is quoted on the poster twice. Not once, but twice. One saying it's absolutely brilliant, and another one saying it's absolutely brilliant, and it's absolutely brilliant. And, you know, it's not... I'm pleased to see that it's doing well, because I really didn't think it had any chance of doing well at all, because for me it was much too sort of toothless. But hey, there we go. What do I know? I just work here.
Dear Mungo and Mitch, having looked on the webcam, has the imposter mode got a cut out of what looks like Bruno Brooks?
No, I think that was either you, well, at the moment, he's holding out a cut out of Keira Knightley.
All right.
Okay. Bruno Brooks is a handsome man, but I don't think he looks much like Keira Knightley.
What a cast of... I'm not quite sure about that. But anyway, let's get something and done with before the president turns.
I'll tell you what I want to do. Let's start with Gomorrah, because this happened last... About you saying, you know, my film of the week, I would hit it, and then it wouldn't. So let's actually start with Gomorrah, because we know we're going to be interrupted by the presidential address. So let's get this out of the way, because this is clearly the film of the week, okay? Obviously, we can't play a clip for you, because it's a foreign language film, but it's this was the Grand Prix...
What foreign language is it in?
It's in Italian foreign language. But okay. What, you want me to play it now, because you're going to pretend that you can understand it?
Why did you say that with a sneer?
Because the point wasn't... Because if you say, I can't play a clip of it because it's in Italian, it sounds like you're making some specific thing about Italian, rather than me saying because it's in a foreign language, meaning not English, which is why I can't play a clip. I'm being non-specifically...
Tell us about the movie.
Okay, it was the Grand Prix winner at Cannes this year, which is the Grand Prix is kind of the sort of runner-up prize to the Cannes to the Palme d'Or, because the Palme d'Or was won by this film, The Class, which I think was a kind of a rather unexpected win. Gomorrah was the one that everybody had sort of tipped up there with Waltz with Bashir, and I think they had expected to win. It's a very, very grim story, inspired by real life, about the Camorra crime syndicate in the Naples area and the environs around there. And of course, in the original title, there's the sound of, you know, Gomorrah and Gomorrah sound very, very similar. So there is a pun which is kind of, to some extent, lost in translation, but that's, you know, that's in the title. The title is also clearly biblical, because Gomorrah, as in Sodom and Gomorrah, you know, hell on earth, city of pestilence and sin. And essentially what you have is this multi-stranded portrait of an area which is in which crime is completely interwoven with the fabric of everyday life, and it pollutes both the life of everyone around and also quite literally the land, because at one level what you have is these kind of big, apparently respectable businessmen who are involved in the dumping of toxic waste for monetary gain. At the other end, you have these sort of very young kids who are absolutely obsessed with the Hollywood version of gangsterism. I mean, for example, there's two kids who are completely obsessed with Scarface, and there's this scene which is actually featured in a lot of the publicity now, with them standing in their underpants firing off machine guns. And in between those two extremes, you have all manner of human life, all completely bound up with this really sort of foul, pestilential web of crime, and all living in some quite clearly purgatorial existence, which I say that's why the title is clearly intended to be biblical. It's a very tough watch. It's very tough for a number of reasons. One of them is it's quite hard to follow, because the director said that the source material is kind of based in, you know, in real events. And he said that what he wanted to do was shoot it in a way that looked like he was shooting a documentary. And it reminded me of, I hate to mention William Friedkin so early on, but I'm going to. William Friedkin, when he made The French Connection, said that he shot it in what he called an induced documentary manner, that he would set the scenes up and then the cameras would just arrive and film the scenes as if they'd just arrived on set. And you get a sense of that with Gomorrah, that what you're watching is some kind of war reporting. The other thing is there's no likable, central, enigmatic character that you can kind of sympathise with and say, oh, well, the glamour of crime, because none of that is in the film at all. What you're getting is this absolutely pestilential worldview in which it is misery and despair and corruption and violence and casual violence and the repercussions of casual violence playing out all amidst this really, really harshly near realistic air. And the guy guy who the book, who wrote the book that this was based on, inspired by, is now under police protection, and apparently has been for quite some time since the book came out. When the film played in Cannes, everyone really raved about it. I mean, I don't know that I love it. I don't know that it's a film that you actually can love, because it's such a tough watch. It's interesting that the guy who wrote the book said that the other person he was looking at as a possibility for directing it was Paolo Sorrentino, who was in that film Il Caimano, the Nanni Moretti movie about corruption under Berlusconi, which I think was very underrated. And then he made that film The Family Friend, which was a really terrific piece of work. And what you have here is a similar sort of really dark, seedy view of the world, but done with kind of real open eyes. It's like somebody standing in the darkness with their eyes wide open, and it is a very tough thing. It's hard to follow, it's hard to watch. There's very, very little sense of, you know, redemption in it. But the thing I kept thinking all the way through it was, somebody should get Guy Ritchie and stick him in a room with this film and put it on a constant loop.
This says, "Hello, Mark and Lard. I haven't been able to listen to the reviews for a while, so I'm confused as to why you always say hello to all the actors. Can you please explain the reason, and in the interest of public service?" Well, we can't really.
We can't. It's one of those things. It's like...
It just is.
Yeah, you can't get there from here, and I couldn't explain to you.
Now, here's a challenge. "Dear Felix and Oscar, right now I am sat here in my office in a leafy-ish bit of central London.
Yeah.
Across the street, a film unit is shooting a Sherlock Holmes movie."
Oh, no, it'll be that one. Go on.
Can I finish?
Yeah, you can.
"Not just any Sherlock Holmes movie.
No.
The Guy Ritchie Sherlock Holmes movie. What should I, as a film lover, do? Disrupt the one-way system, frighten the sandwiches and set fire to Robert Downey Jr.'s hat? Or should I just look the other way as yet another crime against cinema is committed, as I did with Shakespeare in Love and Agent Cody Banks 2, Destination London, both of which I now deeply regret? And in the years to come, when my daughter says, 'Daddy, what did you do when Guy Ritchie was across the road making that Sherlock Holmes film?' What will I say? Will it be enough to say, 'But others stood by also. It's a dark place I am in. Could the doctor please shine a light?'" That's Steve Brown, somewhere in London, BA Honours, MA Oxon, if we're still doing that, by the way.
It's just a terrifying thought, isn't it? I mean, I just can't imagine.
What should he do? Moral advice, please.
No, I mean, I think it's one of those cases in which you simply have to walk away. You have to just walk
the other
away.
Way.
Yes, pretend it's not happening. I mean, you know, the idea of what Guy Ritchie is going to do with Sherlock, I'm just, "All right, Sherlock, yeah, blimey. Strike a light." But, you know, hey, Robert Downey Jr. Look, there's always the possibility that somebody as completely rubbish at making films as Guy Ritchie might at some point make a good film. I mean, you know, hey, I think the chances are low, but it might still happen. So, you know, you can never prejudge anything. You have to wait and see. But I would, if I were you, I'd move house, actually, if they're doing it across the street.
Gary in Belfast, "Dear Tweedledee and Tweedlemayo, I hope you're happy. I've just run out of my classroom early to hear the reviews from start to finish. Here's hoping it's up to the usual. Because I'd hate to get fired for a poor review. So let's do a really good one this time, Mark. What else is new?
Let's
this
do
week?
House Bunny, okay? Right. Described in the publicity as a sexy comedy. Whenever anything says sexy in the publicity, run for the hills. From the writers of Legally Blonde, which I liked. And with the star of Assorted Scary Movies, which I really hated. And so the story is Anna Faris, who everybody tells me is really smart. Anna Faris is an orphan who grows up to be a pulchritudinous Playboy bunny, now living in the Playboy mansion. Here's a clip.
So, Shelley, are you a centerfold?
Oh, she wishes. Yeah, I do. So keep all your fingers crossed. Hopefully Hef will give me the good news this weekend at my birthday party. I've got my turn-ons all ready and everything. Being a centerfold is the highest, most prestigious honor there is. It says, "I'm naked in the middle of a magazine. Unfold me."
See, so you think, okay, fine, it's going to be a satire on the stupidity and sexism of Playboy. As I said, Anna Faris is apparently very smart. Gets even more promising when she gets a letter from Hugh Hefner, which says, "You're 27, therefore you're too old to be here, out by daybreak." She moves out. She has to move into a sorority house where she, through unlikely plot circumstances, becomes the sorority house mother. And the sorority house is entirely full of, you know, misfits and people who don't fit in and people who are unpopular. So you think, okay, this is going the right way. This is all about how ghastly the whole Playboy image of women is and how this is going to be something else. But no, plot twist ahoy, Hugh Hefner comes back and it turns out he didn't write the letter. He was stitched up. And how do we know this? Because Hugh Hefner himself is in the movie. Here's clip number two.
"I'm so glad to be back.
Marvin, tell Shelley we're back and we're going to be watching a movie.
How about something spooky? No, funny.
No. How about Scarface?
No, you guys, I think it should be Shelley's pick tonight.
Mr. Hefner, Shelley's actually gone. She told me to give you this letter.
Shelley moved to Africa to work with the orphans. She left while we were gone because she says she can't deal with goodbyes. I'm going to bed. No movies tonight.
So just to be clear about this, Hugh Hefner is in fact a caring, sharing, loving person who's so upset that one of his favourite Playboy bunnies has gone off to do something else that he just wants to be alone. Now, no surprise to learn, therefore, that the movie is in fact co-produced by a company who are, here's what it says in the thing, the producers scored a huge coup when Alta Loma Entertainment, a subsidiary of Playboy Enterprises Inc., secured Hugh Hefner's participation in the filming and opened up the legendary Playboy Mansion. So So a subsidiary company owned by Hugh Hefner cleverly secured the participation of the person who owns the company. I mean, that must have been a really, really tough call. Then there's another quote from the producer, Alan Covert, who said, he was awesome. We got to shoot in his bedroom and I sat on his bed and we were so thankful that Hef let us use his mansion. So basically what you've got is this thing which from the outside looks like it's masquerading as, you know, a perfectly legitimate satire on the grotesque view of womanhood that Playboy puts forward, but actually completely put as a sort of advertisement for what a fabulous guy Hugh Hefner is, made and produced by people who absolutely love Hugh Hefner and love the Playboy Mansion. No surprise then that what actually happens is that when Shelley gets to this sorority house, she teaches all the girls to be popular by basically dressing and behaving like bunny girls. And there's a little bit at the end of it when suddenly they say, oh, well, you know, there's more to life than just wearing a Wonder Bra. But the heart of the producers clearly isn't in it. The producers, incidentally, one of whom is Adam Sandler, whose presence is writ large all over the whole movie. Now, look, here's the thing. When that movie got made about Larry Flint, The People versus Larry Flint, okay, which he had to give certain permissions, Larry Flint allowed, effectively, a movie to be made that portrayed him as a really, really unpleasant person. There was a lovely quote from Larry Flint, which is that thing, you know, if the First Amendment can protect a scumbag like me, think what it can do for you. Larry Flint was never in the market of telling anyone he was a nice guy. When I was doing the Linda Lovelace documentary, we tried to interview Al Goldstein, and he was unfortunately unavoidably arrested as he entered the building that he was coming in to do the interview in. These are people who are, you know, outsiders. Hefner, on the other hand, is this real establishment figure and wants you all to believe that he's a great American hero. And I'm sorry, I don't think it's funny. I just don't get the suddenly, hey, the guy who invented Playboy is a great American hero and we all love him. You can't have your cake and eat it. You're either making the house bunny and saying, look, all this bunny stuff is complete nonsense, and any film that tells women that aspiring to be a bunny, you know, should essentially be taken out and put out of its misery. But on the other hand, saying, oh, Hef, but he's so great and the Playboy thing is so great and the Playboy mansion is so great. Blah-dy, 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 blah-dy. Is it funny? No. Is it subversive? No. Did I feel at all entertained? No. Is it going to be number one? Is it going to be number one in the box office next week? Very probably.
Tony says, Dear Colonel Mustard and Professor Plum, I normally have to listen to your weekly tete-a-tetes either in the car or later via podcast, but today I happen to be at home and can not only listen but also watch the shenanigans. It's wonderful. The cool doctor is ranting away at cardboard faces and sometimes forgetting the camera is on and then remembering. It's brilliant. He's obviously frustrated that you're not there to shout at personally. Something I'll continue to watch if ever found at home again on a Friday afternoon. Who are you ranting at then? When you just lost control?
You! There's a cardboard cutout of you.
Still me.
But the thing is, it's not reacting, which is really kind of, you know, if anything, you know, it's like that thing. If you're getting cross with somebody and they don't react, it just makes you crosser. You know, I mean, okay, maybe
or
it's just me.
Cross,
maybe, yeah,
probably.
But maybe it's just a psychopathic tendency.
And on the subject of the worst comment ever in a cinema, Dear Sodom and Gomorrah, this says, I saw Midnight Express at a cinema in Tyneside in the early 80s. After the titles, the woman behind me said in a very loud voice, oh, he didn't tell me it was about trains. And then after the student gets taken off the plane and arrested at gunpoint for smuggling drugs, she explained, blimey, all that trouble for smuggling chocolate.
Let's do Mirrors, okay, which is a loose remake of a, well, not intentionally loose, remake of a Korean horror movie, which was called Into the Mirror by Kim Song-ho. This is directed by Alexandre Aya, who's the French guy who made Switchblade Romance, which I absolutely love. And you had the star of Switchblade Romance come on the programme a couple of years ago when the movie played at Fright Fest. It was a terrific thing. So there's a kind of international pedigree. So on the one hand, you've got this Korean film. On the other hand, you've got American production. You've got a French director and French writer, Gregory Levasseur. However, what you end up with is just another Hollywood potboiler. The story is Kiefer Sutherland is a troubled cop who, in the past, before the movie started, killed an undercover policeman and is now then spiralling into drink and guilt, which apparently has messed up his marriage and his job has fallen apart. So he ends up getting a job working as a night watchman in the burnt-out remains of a department store in which... On his own, of an evening, he becomes frightened not only of his own reflection, but of everyone else's. Here's a clip.
I swear to you, I could feel my flesh burning. I couldn't breathe. It was like my lungs were full of smoke. It was like a nightmare, but I was awake. I know I was awake. You think I'm crazy, don't you?
I don't know what to think. I think you're just going through a hard time in your life. You're under a lot of stress. You've been having those nightmares since the shooting. You know it wasn't your fault.
They're everywhere.
What are you talking about?
The mirrors, they are everywhere. In the department store, on the corner of every street, in the window of every building in the city. I feel like I'm not the one looking into the mirrors, but they're looking back at me.
There's no one looking back at you through the mirrors. You're still conflicted about what happened. Maybe you need to talk to someone.
But of course, he's not just conflicted. There are people looking back at him from the mirrors and a whole bunch of bad stuff is going to happen, which plays out in a very kind of nuts and bolts way. And the plot becomes increasingly ridiculous and ends up with possessed nuns and great big CGI punch-ups, sort of vaguely reminiscent of the CGI battles at the end of Rennie Harlin's terrible Exorcist for the beginning. So on the plus side, Alexandre Aya is a stylish director. I mean, he does know how to put, you know, things together in a way that's kind of gripping and looks flashy. And I also think that there's there are a couple of nice touches. They don't bottle out at the very, very end. It's got there's a thing at the end of the movie that when it played in the cinema that I saw, critics originally laughed at it, and then they realised that they were laughing at something that actually wasn't what they thought it was. So it did end up on a nicely sort of slightly creepy note, and so that's fine. The problem with it is that, like all of these kind of Asian imports into Hollywood, what it's essentially done is dumbed it down and cranked up the volume. So you get the ideas don't make as much sense as they did in the original. I have to be honest, the original ideas didn't make that much sense either. There's a very interesting sort of play on the ideas that any reflecting surface, you know, is potentially scary. There's a point when the taps apparently become possessed by the devil and all this water spews out all over the floor, making the whole of the floor into a reflecting surface. And those ideas, those kind of paranoid ideas about reflection, which we've seen in things like Candyman and other movies beforehand, are played out quite well. But the plot just becomes sillier and sillier and sillier and sillier. And then in that standard way, which you do with, you know, with these big Hollywood blockbusters, is in for the last sort of, you know, act, they feel like they have to have everything blow up. Everything has to explode and everything has to, you know. And it's a problem because in the end, those kind of movies work well because they work on sort of psychological creaks and shadows and that sort of stuff. It's not to do with them being action blockbusters. And there's a terrible thing which has happened, which is that somehow horror has hybridized into action. And I don't know why that's become the case, because being horrified is not the same as watching an action movie. So in the end, you end up thinking, well, you know, it's big and dumb and empty, but it's not without merit. There are certain things in it that are quite nice. It's quite stylishly shot and I quite like the end, but it's pretty disappointing.
I've never heard the word hybridized before.
Well,
there's no reason why it shouldn't exist, but
it's a hybrid of the word hybrid and ized.
Have you just created that word?
I'm sure the word hybridized exists already, and I'm sure that if it doesn't, somebody will send me a stiff email from the BBC. A
couple of interesting points from Martin in London. This is on the daft things people say in cinemas.
Oh, yeah.
In The Lord of the Rings, The Return of the King, at the scene of the Battle of Helm's Deep,
yes,
my friend made the comment, well, that's fake. Those torches wouldn't stay alight in the rain.
Very good.
Never mind the dragons and the orcs. It was the rain and the torches.
And so incidentally, torches would stay alight in the rain. It's actually one of those odd things, but they do. In the same way that, you know, there was all this stuff in the press about if a cigarette can't actually ignite petroleum, which seems insane. Like, I'm sure it can, but some scientists were saying, no, well, torches will stay alight in the rain.
Well, if it's got burning pitch on it, I suppose that's going
to... No, exactly. That's exactly what it is. That was the word I was looking for. It's pitch. That's the key to it. It's not to do with the flame. It's to do with the thing underneath the flame that's actually hot that causes that to happen.
And Martin continues, I'm feeling pretty stupid, by the way, at the moment. I don't get the Meg Ryan joke.
I think for legal reasons, I don't think I can explain it.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live